Today on Vox Talks Economics, will debt derail climate change policy? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe to us. Hey, and give us a review as well. 5 stars. Mitigating and adapting to climate change is economically rational, but it's also expensive, and it's not clear how the cost should be financed or which countries or actors are going to assume the burden. A 25th Geneva report from CPR out now investigates these questions. Beatrice Veda Di Mauro and Ugo Panizza, both of the Graduate Institute in Geneva, are two of the authors. They both join me now. Beatrice, welcome back to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim. Good to be back.
And Ugo, great to have you back as well.
Thanks, Tim.
Beatrice, you distinguish in this report between mitigation and adaptation. So what's the difference? What type of spending is each path going to imply?
Mitigation is where most of the concentration right now is when we're talking about climate change. Mitigation is the bill for paying for the path to net zero. And net zero by 2050 means that we have to reduce as a globe emissions, which at the moment are around 40 gigatons per year in CO2, about 60 tons, gigatons of greenhouse gases, to something very close to zero, and the rest may then be compensated. That's the idea of the path to net zero. What is also implicit in that path is that we only have a limited amount of gigatons left that we can put up into the atmosphere unless we want to seriously breach the target of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. So mitigation is all the actions that need to take place in order to transform our transportation, the way we move, the way we live, the way we make things, and bring down the carbon dioxide mostly and other greenhouse gases that this implies. The bills on that vary, but there is almost something like a little bit of a competition at the moment, it seems to me, who can put a bigger number on it. And McKinsey has at the moment, I think, probably the winning one, which is somewhere in the area of 250 trillion. The trillions are going up here per year. We're talking between 3 and 6 trillions. And most of that is mitigation. Most of the mitigation has to take place where the tons are. In other words, in the advanced countries. And the adaptation, when we come to your second question, a lot of the adaptation will have to happen where the, let's call them victims of climate change are, because even if we stick with the 1.5 degrees Celsius, a lot of the climate change that is already happening and that will happen with 1.5 degrees will have strong implications for sea levels rising, for heat waves, etc. And adaptation refers to the kind of investment that has to be made in order to shelter as much as possible populations from these consequences. So, you know, if you want to be very rough and dirty, mitigation has to happen mostly where the emissions are now, and adaptation is more a problem for the regions where the strongest impact of climate change will be. They also happen to be the ones that are not emitting so much right now.
So another distinction that we may want to think about, Beatrice said who needs to incur in these expenses geographically. But if we think about financing, we can think that mitigation, a big chunk of it will come from the private sector, which will have to invest in technologies that emit less. Well, adaptation is mostly from the public sector. So if you think about building, you know, dams and protecting, you know, cities from flood and so on and so forth. So the financing is also different in the sense that it's the adaptation has a lot to do with public expenditure, which will have to be financed.
Also, the report makes it clear these are very complicated questions. They are political questions. They are efficiency questions. They are ethical questions as well. How long have we got to find answers?
We don't have much time left. I think I already mentioned the fact that we have a limited amount, the so-called carbon budget. If we want to stay really below the 1.5, then the answer is a bit less than 300 gigatons that can still be emitted. And then full stop, that's it. Or put differently, if we go above the 300 gigatons, then the probability of staying below 1.5 becomes very small. So the truth is that there is very little time left.
So, and one of the surprising statistics that jumps out from the report is that 60% of emissions are produced by 4 countries. So one thing that might occur to people as a way of sort of cutting through all these problems is to say they pay 60% of the bill. Is that a good idea?
Yes, they will be paying 60% or more of the bill because, you know, again, where the emissions are is where the mitigation needs to happen. But as Ugo was already pointing out, that's not necessarily the public sector that has to pay the bill. If the public sector, for instance, imposes a carbon tax, then the private sector has a strong incentive to do the necessary investments to mitigate CO2 and at the same time is actually creating revenues for the government. So it's a lot of the mitigation incentives will come through regulation. Some of it will also come through subsidies. I mean, there are choices that are being made in the US. They're going more for subsidies than for taxation, or for increasing the price of the dirty activities. Rather, you know, they subsidize the clean ones. So in terms of what it means for the public sector in the advanced countries or in the countries that have the high emissions, because the biggest emitter is China, followed by the US and then the European Union. So that's where the tons are. That's where the bill will be for reducing them. But it's also true that these are the countries where a lot of the, if you want to call it climate debt, lies in the following sense. A lot of the past emissions that are already up in the atmosphere actually come from these countries. And therefore, one could argue, and in fact, Paris does to a certain extent already argue this, that there is also a responsibility of these countries for helping the rest of the world to jump to clean technology and also for some of the adaptation spending that may be needed.
So, Ugo, the title of this report is Climate and Debt. So let's have a look at that debt side. Whoever pays, they have to raise the money somehow. And green bonds is something that you discuss in the report. How do green bonds help? Are they vulnerable, green bonds, as well, to the accusations that some people make that they are an instrument for greenwashing?
We teamed up in writing this report with 2 sovereign debt lawyers. And, you know, and sovereign debt lawyers kind of go and read carefully the contracts in the bonds. We can think of green bonds issued by corporations and green bonds issued by country, by sovereigns. And in this report, we focus on the one issued by sovereigns. And one thing that we learned from our lawyer friends, that basically none of these green bonds commits the government to do anything.
Yeah.
And this, in a sense, it makes sense because, you know, the allocation of the budget in a democratic country is discussed by the parliament. And so when you think in this way, it's hard to think that a country can commit through a bond contract to do something which is no political process. But it's a bit strange because you have these green bonds and says, you know, we're going to do all this nice stuff. And then the bond says, well, but, you know, at the end, it's the parliament that decides what to do. So what we ask ourselves in the report, even though there is no legal bite, is there some sort of moral obligation or reputational obligation? And we find that there is something of it. It seems that countries which are more at climate risk are rewarded a little bit more for issuing these green bonds. But I don't know if Beatrice agrees with me, but I think the jury is still out on this. One thing that we take a stand, and I think it's right, is that most of the green bonds issued are green bonds that work this way. Say, give us this money and we will use this money to do some green activity. Will, you know, build a solar farm, a wind farm, or do some specific type of investment. What it would probably be better is to have what are called sustainability linked bonds. So I don't specify how I get there, but I specify an outcome. I'm going to cut emission by X percent. That seems to be a better way to try to achieve climate targets through bonds which specifically target some outcome rather than the methods how to get there.
Beatrice, do you agree?
Oh, yes, of course. What is an additional point that we make in the report and Ugo did not mention is we also went chasing the so-called greenium, the difference between what is the yield of a brown and a green bond when they are matched as much as possible, sort of creating a hypothetical twin of the two. In some places, they actually do emit, countries emit green and brown bonds that are very, very similar, except for the label. And The question then becomes, is there a reward, in fact, for emitting green bonds? And the literature already is pretty mixed on this. And what we do in the exercise sort of confirms a very mixed picture. There may be a small greenium, but operational word here is small. Definitely, we are not talking about huge differences in financing costs. So most of the time, it's actually not really significant. So on the one hand side, on the financing, it's not so clear. On the other hand side, on the projects, it's not so clear, as Ugo was mentioning, a country that says, I'm issuing a green bond in order to finance a solar project, whether they wouldn't have done that solar project just by issuing regular vanilla bonds. After all, the government had already decided to do so. And so the sustainability-linked bonds do offer a better possibility of really linking, in fact, the outcome that the country wants to achieve and that the investor may be willing to finance to the instrument.
The costly impact of climate change is being felt in many places that can least afford it. To find out more, listen to our episode called Boiling Point in Africa from January 2021.
Ugo, when I was reading the report, I thought I'm going to go and have a look and see how many green bonds there are. And I found out it's about 3 or 3.5% of issuance. Well, it's been 15 years now, I think, since the first green bonds showed up. Does this lack of scale mean that as a concept, they really haven't taken off? They failed?
Well, so here again, the glass, it's maybe 3/4 empty and 1/4 full. So as you mentioned, in terms of share, they're still very, very small. They are growing rapidly, though. So that's, I guess, the 1/4 full. But to make them effective, we have to address these issues that we just discussed. And so it might be the real way forward is thinking more about this sustainability-linked bond. And there is something which we don't discuss in the report, but Beatrice and I discussed a bit recently. It's a relatively new development, that there is a backlash from the financial industry and even from some policymakers in the US against the ESG-linked industry, right? The financial industry starts saying we have some fiduciary duty with respect to our investor. It's not clear. Maybe these type of instruments are in violation of our fiduciary duty. So I see a lot of new movement, which I find worrisome.
There is a clear backlash against ESG in certain parts of the United States. It's becoming part of the polarized debate in the US, and what comes out of the US usually doesn't stay there. So I'm expecting that some of this will also spill over into other countries and that there may be an ESG pushback. But the things that we're talking about here, namely how to finance adaptation investment, how to finance mitigation of emissions in poorer countries, because that's where also the report focuses on most. It's not so much about the Europe and the US and how they can mitigate, but rather how to find the fiscal space in countries that already have very little and may be facing debt distress on top of it. So there, anything related to outcomes and that can leverage and catalyze additional private investment into these countries should be highly welcome.
Now, I want to talk some more about some of these financial instruments. If we go back a couple of years and we were having this conversation, our younger selves would have had it more or less entirely about setting a price for carbon, because that's what economists tend to talk about in these circumstances. Ugo, do we still believe that we can solve a large amount of these problems by just finding the right price for carbon?
Let's split this in two questions. So until recently, and I guess I was one of them, we thought, at least I thought, that a carbon tax would solve 99% of the problems. And a carbon tax, in a sense, is a price to carbon. Now, I still think that a carbon tax is important, but there are several issues with it. The most important one is probably political feasibility of a carbon tax high enough to solve the problem. If the question on the price for carbon is on the carbon tax, I'm much more skeptical than what I was a few years ago. If we think about having a price for carbon, which comes out from setting some global cap to carbon emission, and then we allow this carbon emission to be traded. And there is a long discussion in the report how we set this cap and how we allocate this cap. Then the pricing of this carbon, which lead to this trading, it's clearly an important component.
But not the cure-all that we thought it would be.
Tim, if I may, I think economists were right and still are right that one would solve, in theory, the problem. Actually, in practice, one would solve the problem if we had the right price of carbon. And the right price of carbon, as calculated by the NGFS, which does these climate scenarios, and which is compatible then with the amount of carbon that we still have left, is somewhere in the area of 150 to 300 euros or dollars per ton. And that is not so far away from what the ETS, the European price on emissions, has been or is. So it's not like there is absolutely no attempt to go through the pricing channel. The problem, however, is that other countries and other parts of the world will not do that. Yeah. So I already mentioned the US is going to go through subsidies rather than taxes. And that's a very big one. And where China is going to land is probably somewhere in a combination of those. So in other words, we are going to get some carbon taxes. We're going to get some carbon prices, but they are not going to be sufficient to solve the problem. So that's why we now, as economists and as anybody pragmatic that is interested in solving the problem, needs to be considering a whole combination of different policies that include a lot of things that we know from the beginning that they won't be the most efficient ones, but they are necessary for political reasons. Right?
Well, let's talk about carbon offsets. To make that work, then we need a global credit market, effectively. Can we build that at the scale that we need?
So the proposal here is a bit different. So we have a carbon offset market, which is completely voluntary at the moment. So firms are already purchasing offsets for the purpose of reducing their declared emissions. And they're buying this on a voluntary market. And this voluntary market prices these tons of carbon somewhere between $2 and $12 per ton. I already mentioned, so the ETS is now, the non-voluntary market in Europe is around 70 to 80. So the voluntary market is actually a quite cheap way of buying emissions rights, and that's why it has a lot of criticism has been applied to these offsets, in the sense that the question is, are they actually really offsetting or not, and over what time frame are they offsetting, are they additional to what would have been done anyway, etc. So that's one of the dimensions of the offset market, sort of fixing the measurement and compliance and verification problem. That is something where there is international efforts going in this direction. But we would go one step further and say that we need to make the path to net zero something that is compulsory, and firms would then be able to purchase carbon offsets at a higher price than at the moment that actually do offset or mitigate a ton on the global scale. If we could get such a global carbon credit market going, that would automatically direct some of the financing towards the countries where there are still carbon sinks to be conserved, where there are still ways to actually offset some of the higher emissions that we will not be able to mitigate. So the short answer is a global carbon credit market is one of the promising ways of getting two things. One, a price ultimately for carbon, and second, a reward for those that do not use the carbon or to take out some carbon out of the atmosphere through the conservation of forests, etc.
So I mentioned at the beginning that this is also an ethical, political problem. There are some low-income countries. They make what seems a reasonable demand that rich countries will help pay for their mitigation, their adaptation. They are often extremely indebted countries. What would the mechanism be if we were to do that? How do we enforce that mechanism?
So the mechanism is what Beatrice was mentioning. So in the report, there are a few maps which are quite striking. One map is the map of who is putting CO2 in the atmosphere. The size of each country is, you know, proportional to how much CO2 you put in the atmosphere. In this map, you cannot see Africa. You cannot see much of South America if you exclude Brazil. So these countries are not putting CO2 in the atmosphere. And some of them are actually absorbing CO2 in the atmosphere because they have large forests. And these countries, they have oil in the ground, they could cut their forest. So this country have big carbon sink, and they should be compensated for preserving this carbon sink. So we could think about some sort of arbitrary transfer, but this is hard to do. Well, everything is hard to do, but one way to transfer resources is exactly through what Beatrice was mentioning. If we had a compulsory carbon market, this carbon market would reach a very large size, and countries and firms in the north that want to offset their carbon emission could do it by directing, by buying this offset from these countries in Africa, which have this very large carbon sink. And this would, number one, lead to the preservation of the carbon sink and at the same time generate large flows from rich to poorer countries, which is exactly what we want. And so these countries also would have resources to invest in adaptation. So that's what we think is the way to do it. How easy it is to do it and to enforce it, that's another thing.
Yes, how easy it is to do it, how feasible it is to do it, Beatrice. That is another political problem, isn't it? There are plenty of high-income countries that are loaded with debt right now. COVID-19 in Europe, there is an energy crisis. Some are still working with the debt burden from the 2008 global financial crisis. Is it politically feasible for politicians to talk at the moment in those countries about taking on more debt, especially if the message from that debt is we have to help other countries?
This does not need to mean more public debt. What this compulsory carbon credit market would actually be private sector. You're either paying the mitigation or you're paying the carbon credit in order to reduce your emissions. So that's a question of regulation rather than of public funding. Now, the question of the moment is we have a war in Europe.
Yeah.
And everybody is struggling to fill their gas storages and to find new sources of gas and oil and coal and whatever, at whatever price. So the whole question of how to get to net zero has been implicitly, tacitly, or sometimes also explicitly pushed into the future, sometimes with a commitment to catch up, save more in the future on emissions, but not really with a strong commitment because we don't know exactly how that's going to happen. So right now, I see a certain disconnect between the discussions about the urgency of addressing climate change globally and the actions that we are doing faced with existential crisis. We are definitely not on the path to net zero, and we are a little bit less so on the path to net zero this year than we were hoping to be. So your question about the political economy of all of this is spot on. How much is the will? How can we master and muster the will? I don't know.
If you want to find out more about this, there is far more in the document. We could talk about this for ages. It's better that you download the Geneva Report and read it. Thank you very much for discussing it this morning, Ugo.
Thank you very much, Tim.
And Beatrice.
Thanks, Tim.
The 25th Geneva Report is called Climate and Debt. You can download it now. It is a free download from cepr.org. If you go along to cepr.org, you cannot miss the download button. It's right at the front. The authors are Patrick Bolton, Lee Buchheit, Mitu Gulati, Ugo Panizza, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, and Jeremin Zettelmeyer.
Next time on Vox Talks Economics, how and why did central banks lose control of inflation?